Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of the forced removal of refugees from the camp in Calais, France, and the mass arrests of Native Americans and their non-Native allies who have erected camps in Cannonball, North Dakota, to oppose the $3.8 billion Dakota Access oil pipeline. Today, we're joined by Ben Ehrenreich. He's an award-winning journalist and author. His latest book, The Way to the Spring, Life and Death in Palestine, is based on his 3 years of reporting from the West Bank. In March, Ben Ehrenreich reported from the Calais camp in France, where people fleeing war and poverty were staying as they waited to cross the English Channel into the UK. You can read Ben's piece, the piece he wrote for the London Review of Books, at yourcallradio.org. Hi, Ben. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. We're also joined by Mark Trahant, an independent journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. Mark is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe and has written about American Indian and Alaska Native issues for more than three decades. In his latest piece about yesterday's more than 117 arrests, he writes, quote, "Every preposterous and painful image from North Dakota is another reminder of injustice. The massive police, military-style occupation of Standing Rock treaty lands, the rush to protect the frantic construction schedule for the Dakota Access Pipeline, and the brutal law enforcement march against people who are fighting for the simple idea that water is life. I'm angry. How shall I say this without ranting? Tell stories," writes Mark Trahant. Hi, Mark. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a more positive note and highlight journalism that really stood out this week. So, Mark, let's start off with you. What caught your attention this week?
Well, first, the folks who are at Standing Rock are just doing a remarkable job under really tough conditions. And I would put on the list Sandy Toland, who's written a piece both yesterday and today for the Los Angeles Times. It's interesting, Sandy, who's also spent a lot of time covering the Palestinian issues, says it reminds him of the occupation, and the same imagery is present. The other is an independent journalist who has a podcast, Jenny Monet, and she's had some photos on Instagram that are just stunning and worth seeing.
All right, so kudos to Sandy Toland, who's been on the show. He's reporting for the LA Times. Jenny Monet has a podcast. Antonia Yuhas, an independent journalist who's been on this show, is also at Standing Rock. She just arrived yesterday. She said that, you know, she covered Afghanistan twice, and she felt like she was in a war zone again. And we'll discuss that later in the show. That's Mark Trahant. He's an independent journalist from North Dakota and a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. And what about you, Ben? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I thought that Sandy Toland piece was excellent as well in the Los Angeles Times. And the other one I would mention came out on Saturday, so it's slightly dated. It was a great piece by Molly Crabapple in The Guardian, headlined "Inside the Impossible Life of a New York Street Vendor," in which she follows a man who sells, you know, food from a food cart on the streets in New York, and who is an organizer of the Street Vendors Project in New York, which has been trying to protect street vendors from police harassment. And you know, as she often does in her pieces, it takes this this one story of a, you know, a single person struggle, but also connects it to you know, to kind of major movements of capital and what they mean for our cities.
Oh, that's it sounds so interesting, because, as you know, us on the West Coast, when we go to New York, people always talk about, oh, I can't wait to get the roasted nuts or the pretzels in the carts. When you say police violence, can you tell us elaborate on that?
Not so much violence, but harassment. You know,
harassment.
Sort of constant ticketing. I live in Los Angeles, and street vendors here deal with the same kind of thing. I mean, people love to talk about taco trucks and taco carts in LA, but the actual vendors are sort of always constantly, you know, just getting by and, you know, barely making survival wages, working long hours, having to deal with you know, constant and expensive tickets from the city, having their carts confiscated and whatnot. And so her piece was a really terrific, you know, show, not just of something awful that's going on, but also of some pretty inspiring organizing to fight back.
Well, sounds like a great piece. So kudos to Molly Crabapple with The Guardian, writing about New York street vendors. And we will link to these pieces at yourcallradio.org. That is Ben Ehrenreich, and he's an independent journalist writing for a number of publications. You can find his work at yourcallradio.org. So, Ben, let's dive in here and talk about what's happening at the Calais camp. You wrote a piece about this for the London Review of Books. And just to give us some context, this camp has been making headlines over the past year because of the influx of refugees into Europe. But the camp has been around since 1994, according to your reporting. How did this camp become such a magnet for refugees?
Well, in 1994, the Eurotunnel opened, connecting France to England. Immediately, refugees and asylum seekers who wanted to go to England ended up going to Calais, and Calais became a destination for people who wanted UK citizenship and wanted to seek asylum in the UK. And in the beginning, this was mainly Albanian Kosovars, Iraqi Kurds, and Afghans. And by 1999, enough had gathered that this is, kind of amazing. This sort of thing is so quickly forgotten, but sort of the last version of this crisis, enough had gathered that the French government hired the Red Cross to build a sort of semi-permanent camp, just outside Calais, in Sangatte, which they built in a warehouse, which had been used for heavy equipment for the tunnel project. And sort of as soon as that was built, the British tabloids and the French press started panicking about, what was called at the time an asylum invasion. And not that long after came the September 11th attacks in the U.S., and suddenly people were talking about Al-Qaeda at Britain's gate. And the following year, in 2002, the U.K., the Home Secretary David Blunkett, and Nicolas Sarkozy, who was then the Interior Ministry of France and, of course, later became a right-wing prime minister, decided to close Sangatte as a, quote, humanitarian gesture. And this has been the story all along there, that at various uses of often fairly extreme levels of state violence are characterized as humanitarian efforts. So they closed it and they scattered everyone around. People kept coming, and in the years that followed, there was always a large presence of asylum seekers and refugees in Calais. Sometimes they would gather in larger groups, and they would be scattered by the police. And what ended up happening was, as more and more people started coming, as things fell apart in Syria and in North Africa, and as people continued to come from Afghanistan and Eritrea and other places like that, we suddenly saw in early 2015 a crisis unfold. And a crisis is, I think, what we call it when pre-existing embarrassing power relations suddenly become visible. In this case, the French decided to deal with it yet again by concentrating the refugees who had gathered in the area, who again were spread out in various parts, wherever they could seek shelter, and in squats and kind of in the woods on the edge of town. And the French authorities told them that they couldn't stay where they were staying. They all had to gather in one area, which was an old abandoned garbage dump just past the dunes outside of town, next to an old government camp named for Jules Ferry, who was one of the founders of the French colonialist project in the 19th century. And so they established this Jules Ferry Day Center, and for a little while allowed people to gather and put their tents up and build temporary structures in the dump around it. And no sooner had they kind of forced everyone into one place than they started to say, there's too many people here. And they started to demolish parts of the camp. And at first they were attempting to, they demolished a large part of the camp not long before I was there. and established a container camp. So they put it, brought in shipping containers, put up barbed wire fencing, had various biometric security in place, and basically told everyone that if they wanted to stay, they would have to move into the containers. But to do so, they would have to register and hand over their biometric data, their handprints. And most of the migrants that I spoke with were unwilling to do that and were frightened. Both that, you know, essentially they were leaving what freedom they had in the camp, which became known as the jungle.
And where are most of the people that you interviewed? Where are they from?
When I was there, and I believe this was still true until the end of this week, when they basically fully demolished the camp. I think the plurality were from Afghanistan, but there were a lot of Eritreans, there were people from South Sudan, there were Iraqis, there were Kurds, there were Syrians, of course. There were North Africans, there were people from Libya. But I would say that certainly the largest group of those were Afghans, but basically every part of, North Africa and the Middle East, and that, has been troubled by violence in the last few years. And of course, both France and the UK have been involved in one way or another, whether it's directly or by selling arms, in most of the conflicts that have pushed people to their doors.
I mean, this is so sad. There's an article in the UK Express called "Dozens of Children Sleeping by Road After Calais Clearance Declared Complete," and there's photos of these children sleeping on roads, and there's just water bottles and garbage just all around them.
Yeah, I mean, the conditions in the camp were quite horrible. I mean, I've lived in the Middle East and reported from all over the world, and I was impressed at how bad the conditions were at the camp. I was there in winter. It was cold. There's always cold wind coming off of the sea. There's a lot of rain. People were basically living in mud. People built sort of temporary wooden structures. A lot of people were sleeping in tents. There were porta potties, but nonetheless, there was clearly sewage everywhere. Some local NGOs had helped build clinics and legal clinics and things like that. And one of the fascinating things was how quickly it turned into a real community. You know, there were restaurants, there were mosques, there were churches, there were schools. There was a radio station for a little while. There was a newspaper run by refugees. Very quickly became a community of its own sort of, despite the conditions, its own vibrancy and life. And all of that, of course, was destroyed on Thursday.
And so what happens to all of these people who've been displaced once again?
Well, it's not entirely clear, but I believe somewhat more than 200 children, and it's only the unaccompanied minors that are being allowed in, have already been sent to the UK and will probably be given asylum there. As you mentioned, there were another at least 100 or so children who the French failed to register, who ended up just sleeping in the streets last night. And I believe the latest report I saw said most of them had been put on a bus and brought somewhere. The reporter who wrote the piece didn't know where. But I think several thousand have been put on buses and brought to various reception centers, they're called, all over France. And the idea basically was to break up this concentration of refugees. So sending 40 or 50, a busload to various towns all over France that have been willing to accept them. And that means that, for the near future, they'll probably be sleeping in schools or in government buildings or wherever these small towns have found for them, as their asylum claims are processed. I think they've said that 6,000, I might be getting these numbers wrong, have already been sent out to these reception centers. Some local NGOs put the camp's population at 10,000 as of last week. So there's a lot of people who aren't accounted for. And I think it's a pretty safe bet that most of them have just scattered further up the coast. You know, when I was there during the winter, there had already been one major demolition in the camp, and they were threatening another major demolition in the camp. And people were moving, those who could, especially, you know, single men, adult men, were going up to other camps in Dunkirk and further up the coast. And, you know, I think it's clear that that's going to continue to happen, that, you know, they're just as with repressive border measures here in the U.S.-Mexico border, that, you know, it doesn't matter how much, you know, how many bulldozers or police or what repressive measures the state brings to the border, as long as people are fleeing for their lives, they're gonna keep coming.
And just quickly, Ben, where are you going for good reporting about this issue?
The Guardian's been pretty good. Some of the local NGOs have been pretty good. Actually, you know, Twitter actually ends up being better than anywhere else these days in terms of finding things.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Ben Ehrenreich is an award-winning journalist and author. You can find the piece he wrote about the Calais camp for the London Review of Books at yourcallradio.org. His latest book is The Way to Spring, Life and Death in Palestine, which is based on his 3 years of reporting from the West Bank. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thank you. And we're going to change gears here now and talk about coverage of what's happening at Standing Rock with Mark Trahant, an independent journalist and member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe who's written about American Indian and Alaska Native issues for more than three decades. Check out his website, Trahant Reports. Mark, Ben said that so many people are getting their news about what's happening with the refugee crisis from Twitter. And I really think Facebook Live has changed the game for what's happening at Standing Rock, because I was just glued to my computer yesterday watching in real time as police were arresting people, seeing tear gas, seeing these MRAPs, the sound cannons. I mean, you're watching this in real time thanks to people who are filming it on Facebook Live.
No question about it. This has been, from the beginning, really a social media story, but especially a Facebook story. And folks have been really adaptive and have been able to, in fact, I was joking the other night on Facebook that they had a Facebook Live event with Mark Ruffalo and a number of water protectors in Dallas Goldtooth. And when it was supposed to go live, it was late. And so I posted, I think every Indian in the country on Facebook is hitting the refresh key every couple of minutes.
Well, and for people who aren't familiar with Facebook Live, so I'm actually heading to Standing Rock this afternoon. And what I can do when I get there with my phone is go on Facebook, you hit go live, and everything that I'm recording shows up on my page in real time. So anyone that I'm connected with can watch what I am videotaping in real time. It's impressive technology. I continue to be blown away by it because you actually feel like you're there.
Well, and it's been critical to telling the story. For example, the Morton County Sheriff's Department has just issued some statements that are flat out not true.
Mm.
For example, during an arrest earlier or last weekend, they said it was in riot conditions and had other kind of fanciful descriptions. And yet people were watching it on Facebook Live, and it was nothing like that. And I think that poses a whole new dimension to this, that the story that's being told by the official sources is just wrong, and people can see for themselves that there's another version of the truth that's more accurate, and it's posted live on Facebook in real time.
Well, speaking of the Morton County Sheriff's Department, the other thing that's fascinating is they're using Facebook to get their story out. I mean, just an hour ago, Morton County Sheriff has two photos up. It says, law enforcement officers continue to maintain a presence at the Backwater Bridge north of the camp. They will hold this area. The bridge remains closed due to numerous fire protectors that have set fire protesters have set on the bridge. I mean, they're going on Facebook on a regular basis to basically tell their side of the story.
Right, and I think they're actually going beyond what's the norm for law enforcement. That picture that you just referenced, I think, is really extraordinary because it shows the line of military vehicles in front of this beautiful spring. And I'm looking at it thinking, this describes the entire fight right here, sheer force versus water, and whose priorities are more important, the water behind these vehicles or the vehicles. The other thing that they've done that I just think is amazing is there is a post earlier this week about chronicling and chart form all of the water protectors who are arrested from out of state. And they said, here's proof that they're out of state agitators. And to have law enforcement do that, I think, is really chilling, because instead of looking at the situation in any kind of objective manner, they're basically saying, these are the enemies and we're going to go after them.
Mark, I want to give some context, because we are bombarded with videos and photos. People are sharing so much. But I want everyone to remember, you know, why this is happening in the first place. So can we just give a couple of facts? Again, the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline will transport up to 570,000 barrels of oil per day from the Bakken areas of North Dakota down through South Dakota, through Iowa, and then on to Patoka, Illinois. That's the final destination. And I was looking at the Energy Transfer website yesterday, and it says that altogether the pipeline will pass through 59 different counties.
Right. There are 2.5 million miles of oil and gas pipelines in this country, crisscrossing in every direction. And what's interesting about this one is they had just been defeated with Keystone XL, and they had been defeated with another pipeline that would have gone across Minnesota, both with regulatory reasons. And so they designed this one very particular to try to avoid all regulation. In fact, the judge said what's amazing for this project is that it's 99% outside of federal review. No environmental impact statement. The only way the federal government had any role at all was when it crossed water. And this is where this particular fight is happening. The Army Corps of Engineers granted a permit to go into the water, but what's interesting is they never granted an easement, and the company went and started anyway. Hmm. And what makes the law enforcement role intertwined with this is the pipeline company has promised its investors that this will be up and running by the end of this year. So they're on this breakneck schedule to get it done, and they don't want any delays of any kind. And law enforcement is being used to make that so. In Oregon, for example, at the Wildlife Center, under federal oversight, they were very methodical and said, let's slow this down, let's talk, let's figure it out, let's not do anything crazy. Here, law enforcement is just the opposite. They're, let's clear the area. This is we need to move this right now. We need to get this construction going. The president has asked that there not be construction 20 miles north of the river, and yet this whole action this week is designed to cross that road and begin construction on its way to the river.
And we should also remind people, and this doesn't get widely reported, that the original route was supposed to go north of Bismarck, which is the capital of North Dakota, 80 to 90% white. When concerns were raised about that, the pipeline was rerouted to basically go to the tribe's doorstep. Now, Mark, I have called the DOJ, Army Corps of Engineers, the governor of North Dakota, the city council of Bismarck to find out who made this decision. Why was this decision made? I cannot find an answer. Do you have an answer?
No, it was somehow in the Public Service Commission, and it was just like one day somebody substituted the plan and said, we have a new plan. And it was very it wasn't up for real public review the way it probably should have been.
Okay, so where can we find an answer about who made this decision?
I think everyone's still looking for the answer. I don't think we know it yet.
This is amazing. I mean, I've been calling the oil company, and they're not calling back. I think this is just such an important piece of information that's not in hardly any of the stories that I've been reading.
No, I agree. And it ought to be. I mean, to me, that moment is when it lost moral authority. And I think it's about bigger issues, but on just the pipeline itself, that moment they lost any moral authority to say, you need to have this right here.
Mark Trahan is an independent journalist and journalism professor at the University of North Dakota. He is a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. And today we are talking about media coverage of the ongoing actions at Standing Rock. Just yesterday, at least 117 Native Americans and their non-Native allies were arrested for resisting the pipeline. Over 300 police officers in riot gear from five different states, this is according to Standing Rock, were armed with batons, tasers, and pepper spray. That you can see in videos. They also had percussion grenades and used a sound cannon. So what are your thoughts on the coverage? I'm looking at the cover of the New York Times today. There is one cover story. U.S. jury acquits all defendants in refuge siege. Remember that? The Bundy brothers in Oregon. We'll talk about that after the break. But no coverage at all of Standing Rock in today's New York Times. In the Chronicle, there is a story on page 8. It's a story by the Associated Press. So what do you make of the coverage that you've been hearing and reading? We'd love to hear from you. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
But this time, the ship bound for the Arctic oil fields would not be stopped. One by one, Warner, the other protesters lowered themselves.
This is your call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
And those were some songs that I found a video with Native Americans singing on the front lines. They were actually singing that with the police almost right in their face. That was from a Facebook Live video yesterday when 117 Native Americans and their non-Native allies were arrested. And today we are talking about media coverage. I'm leaving for Standing Rock this afternoon and we'll be doing a show from Bismarck, North Dakota on Tuesday. So I hope you can tune in for that. And we're joined today by Mark Trahan, an independent journalist and member of the Shoshone Bannock tribe. Mark has been covering all of this extensively. Okay, Mark, so we talked about we just got another guest, and I wasn't sure we were going to reach her because she is in North Dakota. And now I would like to welcome Jihan Hafiz to the show, an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. Over the past 8 years, she has covered huge events in Latin America, the Middle East, and Europe. She got arrested on October 22nd with more than 140 people during an action at Standing Rock. Hi, Jihan. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. So you wrote about your arrest for The Intercept. You write that when you were arrested, two Native American men were thrown into solitary confinement. A number of women faced humiliating strip searches, which included spreading their body parts and jumping up and down while coughing. So I was just talking to Mark Trahan about trying to get answers and how it's incredibly difficult. I've been calling the sheriff's office for the last 2 weeks to find out why people are being strip searched and who's making these decisions. Have you been able to find an answer to that question?
No, we haven't, and we have asked. A lot of media have also had their cameras confiscated as evidence to a quote crime, as they called it. And we haven't been able to receive any information from the sheriff's department about their conduct as well. There's a number of different violations that we witnessed in jail that I didn't mention in that article. I have to say, though, the people who are receiving the worst treatment are the Native people. As I mentioned, the two Native men who were thrown in solitary confinement, that's 32 hours in solitary confinement, were both Native. They were not acting out of line. They weren't doing, I think they were leaders. They were leading it, and that's why they took them. The only women who were injured that day were the Native women. So it's clear that those who are receiving, and those who were strip searched and faced the most humiliating aspect of that strip search were also mainly the Native women. And if you just saw the conditions that we were in jail, there was really no space for anyone to lie down on the floor in the common area. Mm. There are holding cells, and inside the cells, that's where they're supposed to put you two to a cell. There are about 30 of us in a place that was only able to contain about 15 to 20. And they didn't serve, you know, they took the right medication. There are a lot of people who fainted at the time, as I mentioned. Mm. We're hearing reports as well that people were black bagged. These are Native men who were black bagged as they were being arrested. And so we're trying to find we're trying to get answers to all of this as well.
Did you say black? What does that mean? Black bagged?
Black bagged is a term. I'm Egyptian. In Egypt, whenever they would take people or people would go missing, they would be black bagged. meaning a black bag over their head and then taken.
Wow.
And so that's the terminology that I'm using in this case, because what they're saying here is that black bags were put over their faces, and they were arrested or they were held. And I'm hearing this also from lawyers. There's a number of lawyers here are investigating that situation and talking to a lot of the Native men that happened to.
Mark, Dr. Sarah Jumping Eagle, a pediatrician on the reservation, told Democracy Now! That she was strip searched and forced to squat and cough. The Standing Rock Sioux chair, Dave Archambault, was also arrested and strip searched. Authorities actually went through his braids. Could you find answers about why people are being strip searched and who's making these decisions?
I'm not sure who's making those decisions, but it's clear it's to humiliate and to denigrate people
and
to rob them of their dignity.
And Mark, have you been able to find any answers?
Well, other than the sheriff and the governor, but it is absolutely about humiliation and trying to show power from the North Dakota, basically saying that you are ours, and in the most humiliating fashion possible. And that's something that's happened for a long time. This is just bringing it to the surface in a really ugly way.
What about the authorities going after journalists like Jihan? And when she was released from jail, her camera was missing. When she asked about it, a police officer said, "Your camera is being held as evidence in a crime." Mark, what really strikes you about how police are arresting journalists and taking their equipment?
Well, that's absolutely part of their strategy. They do not want, a combination of making sure that journalists are on notice, taking away equipment, making sure there's no drones that are photographing what's going on, and getting the FAA to help with the no-fly zone. There's just pressure on trying to get their side of the story as the only story when we know it factually just doesn't hold up. And these independent corroborations have called them out. And that's why we need to keep pressing to get more people telling every camera, every Facebook Live, actually is the kind of evidence that's needed to show what they're doing.
Jihan, you wrote a piece for The Intercept along with video, but Facebook Live is really changing everything. It's exposing
Absolutely.
So much about what's happening on the ground at Standing Rock. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. So, as Mark mentioned, the world of social media and on-the-ground reporting has completely changed, because you have, if you're looking to interview a protester, that protester just reported live from the spot. And a lot of the times when they're reporting live, it's as the action's taking place. So you can see from a lot of these live feeds, people being shot in the face with tasers, with beanbags, pepper sprayed at point-blank range, shot at with non-lethal weapons with point-blank range. These are things that you don't have to wait for us to report. The people on the ground with their own phones are, and they're not inventing these images. These are as they're happening. And so it's really incredible to not just see the live feeds that are coming out of this, but to see the indigenous and native people reporting on their own story. There are a lot of native media people, journalists, who have been doing incredible reporting because this is their land, and they're obviously very close to the subject. And that has completely changed the game in how things are being. I've reported on the Egyptian Revolution, the revolutions all over the Middle East and Brazil during their uprising, and that's what I've seen that's different in this one, is that the use of social media, of drones, of people on the ground, of live feeds, that's really that's being reported on the ground. So while the mainstream media is ignoring it, it's being reported live on social media for anyone in the world to see.
Yeah,
we're getting reports from Egypt, from South Africa, from all over the world of people watching it on social media, not on the news, but that's how they're seeing it. People all over the world are watching this on social media.
Right, and that also comes in during real time. Mark, can you jump in there? What about Native Americans telling their own story on the ground?
One story yesterday that came out that I think is really extraordinary was man working for the Dakota Access Pipeline Company, who was pretending to be a water protector, who had a rifle in his possession. He was run off a ditch, got out of his vehicle, was in the water, and folks went and calmed him down before he shot anybody. But in his paperwork was his actual employment. So the idea, this is a story where people on the ground are showing infiltration in a way that's really extraordinary, that this is your tax dollars at work. Law enforcement was complicit. He's been arrested, actually, by the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, and it'll be interesting to see that trial on the other side of it, because that's outside of the state's jurisdiction.
I also want to talk about...
Mark,
go ahead. Jihan.
Well, I just want to, I filmed that scene, and it was really an extraordinary scene. I never, I couldn't believe I was actually filming it, because there was this guy in the water with a rifle, and when I arrived, and the BIA, I'd followed the BIA into the scene, and they took out sniper rifles, to, you know, if they had to take this guy out, if he started shooting, you know, so it was really a scene where the BIA had come in to remove this guy, because no one, in, you know, the crowd here is not, they can't defend themselves with live ammunition. So, you know, people were really tense. There are women, there are children here. And this is not the front line. This is right next to the camp that this guy was. So that's not being reported either. And I think it was a really extraordinary thing that a security guard from the pipeline was here with a rifle, you know, far beyond where the front line is.
And can you talk more about that, Jihan? BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, what is their role there? I read or saw that when they arrived, a lot of people were cheering.
I don't know their exact role and jurisdiction over this area where they came into. I'm hearing conflicting reports, but obviously they were welcomed by the people when they came, because they were coming. They were there's some. I'm sorry. There's a development taking here. I'm at the front line, but a lot of people were very thankful to them for coming, because the guys could have, you know, anything could have happened at that moment. Things were really volatile at the moment. They were happening so quickly. At, you know, prior to that, there are reports. I filmed these two 19-year-old boys who had been shot at with live ammunition on their horses. One horse was injured. So, you know, this was all happening so fast. And anything could have happened in the water. So when the BIA came, obviously the people were very thankful, you know, that they were protected and that they didn't have to worry about their safety. Well, at least at that point with that guy.
And Mark, do you know what role the BIA plays in all of this?
Yes. If it was within the boundaries of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, then the Bureau of Indian Affairs is the primary police agency. And the river would have been within their jurisdiction.
That is Mark Trahant, an independent journalist in North Dakota and a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe. We're also joined by Jihan Hafiz, an award-winning journalist who was arrested covering Standing Rock on October 22nd. She was arrested with more than 140 Native Americans and their allies. Yesterday, 117 people were arrested. You know, we're talking about Native Americans telling their own stories, but we should also talk about what they're going through while they're telling these stories. And Candy Mossett, who's been on this show many times with the Indigenous Environmental Network, she films from the front lines, and she had a statement saying, "I went to the front line in prayer for protection of the Missouri River and found myself in what I can only describe as a war zone. I was sprayed in the face with pepper spray. The guy next to me was shot by something that didn't break the skin but appeared to have broken the ribs. Another guy was randomly snatched violently by police, shoving me into the officers who held me off with batons and then tried to grab me." She goes on to say, "I'm still in shock and keep waiting to wake from what's surely a nightmare, though this is my reality as a Native woman in 2016 trying to defend the sacred." That's Candy Mossett with the Indigenous Environmental Network. So, Mark, we're talking about Native Americans telling their own stories, but they're also, I mean, just look at what Candy just wrote and what she dealt with yesterday. It seemed like a lot of people were very, very shaken up last night.
Yeah, I think yesterday was just one of those ones where even those of us that were not there kept checking in with just this sinking feeling in their hearts, as I wrote this morning. It just, it was mind-boggling because it didn't have to be handled like that. In fact, one really interesting press angle that we haven't mentioned is that I've been getting calls from the oil and gas industry whose own press recognizes how terrible this is being handled and how this is undermining everything that they want to do.
What are they saying?
They're just saying, one, North Dakota and the company is not handling it well, that they're, instead of being transparent and trying to win allies, they're trying to arrest everybody and force the decision on people.
How do you explain this level of violence? I mean, again, there's an MRAP there. People have earplugs because they're using sound cannons, 5 armored vehicles, 2 helicopters, military-grade Humvees, 300 officers from 5 different states. How do you explain this level of violence?
This is North Dakota. This is the governor's decision, and it really falls on him. One of the things I heard at camp that I kept trying to explain to people is they say, well, the National Guard works for the president, and therefore that he's involved too. But the way it works is the governor is actually in charge and the adjutant general of the National Guard. This is really a North Dakota decision, and when there are trials in the future, it will be North Dakota that will be judged guilty for its complicity.
Jihan, you're on the front lines. We were just hearing something there. What's going on right now?
Negotiating with the police because they're heavily armed. a lot of them do have lethal weapons. They do have machine guns and military artillery. And so, you know, it's a little bit tense here. And as Mark mentioned last night, it was a war zone, and it was really an intense moment for a lot of people. A lot of people couldn't sleep last night because of what they witnessed. And just in regards to what Mark said about the systemic racism here, when I was filming some of the police officers, and they didn't know I was just hiding to the side, just trying to get their audio, they were saying very vulgar things about Native people, very absurd, hateful things about Native people. When I was in Bismarck and I went to go buy, I think, gas or soda or something, they look at me, and I assume they think I'm Native, in a very nasty manner. You can feel their racism. This is not something that just happened. This is a 500-year-old struggle on a land with people who have always been fighting for their rights. Mm. So I think that what they're doing is, you know, they're just trying to, they're continuing to fight a spirit that can never be broken here. And you can really feel that. I don't know if Mark mentioned, but there was a stampede of buffalo that came out at the height of the violence yesterday. You can assume that's a coincidence, but for a lot of Native people here, that was a calling from their ancestors. This has to do with the history of this land. It doesn't have to do, not to, I mean, the pipeline is the basis of it, but the state of the Dakotas and the treatment of Native people in this country has always been on the levels of war. It's always been a level of warfare. Before the pipelines, there were still a number of Native Americans who were being killed by the police. In fact, there have been studies where the highest rate of people being killed in this country are Native people, then Black people. So, you know, the feeling that Native here are facing something much worse than us outsiders are ever going to feel coming in. Mm. They live here. They deal with this. They could go missing. When they go into town, they're completely discriminated against. And when I've seen it, when the police arrest them, they are very violent. When they take them down and they give themselves in peacefully, they body slam them. That's, you know, they don't do that to the white allies or, I mean, they did it to me, but it was a different situation. They didn't body slam me, but they just pushed me. Mm. But the thing is that it's Native people who are facing the brunt of this, who have been facing the brunt of this, which is why they're standing so strong here. And it's been a really incredible thing to witness in 2016. Native people who they've been trying to hold down for so long stand their ground and you know, and fearless. This is the front line of military. This is what you see in Syria. I mean, I saw this in Libya, in Gaza, in Egypt when I was reporting there. I never thought I would see it in North Dakota at the mount, you know, right here on Indian land.
Mm. Mark, what about that larger issue surrounding racism against Native people on their own land?
Last night I was with Chase Iron Eyes, who's actually married to Dr. Jumping Eagle, and he's running for Congress, and so he's out across North Dakota a lot. And he said, you know, the thing about this whole episode is somehow we're going to have to go beyond this and figure out a way to have a conversation. There's going to need to be some sort of serious way to involve in reconciliation, because no one from Standing Rock is going anywhere. They're here for the next millennial. And folks in North Dakota are going to have to figure out how to have some sort of community with that. And I thought, in fact, I ended my article today, that instead of even beginning that conversation, both the sheriff and Dakota Access Partners are saying, we will arrest and prosecute everybody. They're basically putting on notice that, no, we're not part of the same community, and you are on notice that we want you gone. And that's just not going to happen.
And Jihan, what is next? I mean, is the plan to arrest everyone? I understand that people are now being taken all over the state because the jails are packed. And for people that have money to pay for bail, they are let out. But in some cases, people are spending 3 nights in jail.
Yes. Well, actually, it's a great that you asked that, because I just got off with one of the lawyers who's been trying to get people out of jail right now in Mandaine and the surrounding counties, and they've raised people's bonds to $1,500, $3,000. I was bonded out with $500. So I think they're intensifying keeping, you know, they're trying to drain the legal team of resources. They're trying to, you know, keep people in jail. And, you know, a lot of people were supposed to be released the next day or at the latest, Monday. But almost all the natives who went in when I was there got out Tuesday night. That's way beyond the time when they were supposed to leave. So I think by them dispersing people, and of course they don't have the space to hold people. They don't have the resources. A lot of the paperwork, and when they wrote down my paperwork, half the information was wrong. So it's clear that there's a lot of there's a lot of disorganization on their part. But I also believe it's a method to try to break the resistance here at the camp, you know, by jailing their people. They jailed a lot of elders. One of the lawyers I was on the phone with, they said they jailed 16 minors. And they're taking a lot of the leaders at the front line. People who were trying to hold the line and be peaceful and push back, they grabbed them out of nowhere. Mm. And whenever there's a Native person that's from the camp, and if they're out somewhere that is beyond our sight, they're also taken. So I think what they're trying to do is drain the camp of their resources and their people.
Let's take a few calls before we end. Let's hear from Jennifer in Berkeley. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. First of all, it seems like what we're witnessing is the criminalization of exercising our First Amendment right. They're criminalizing protests, not unlike they're criminalizing homelessness. That's number one. And number two, you know, the silence by the media needs to be not only questioned, it's like, well, why isn't the media covering this? Remember the adage, silence is consent. And I think we need to challenge and literally put the media on trial for what they're not
yes.
doing. And I'm so glad the woman previously was talking about the fact that contained in this battle, and maybe this is our present day battle of Wounded Knee, is all the other battles and struggles of the Native Americans. And it seems like today, when we really need to seek their advice regarding the care of the planet, Mother Earth, this is like such a slap in the face. It's like it's just so not okay.
Well,
so I'd like to hear.
Thank you for calling in, Jennifer. And we just got an email from Lisa who says, looking over my New York Times app feed, Standing Rock isn't anywhere. And it's, I get the paper. It's not in the paper at all. But
yeah.
Mark, the AP is there. And so the same AP story that was written is in probably most papers today. But I'm noticing that a lot of the coverage, now that things are, so many people are being arrested, there's a major standoff, it's specifically about that. Not much information about the pipeline, about the water, or the fact that people have been peacefully gathering since April.
Yeah, you're right. And it's funny because it's been, one, a social media story, and then, two, an international story. BBC and The Guardian were there the first week, and yet the U.S. media has just been so slow to figure this out. And I think once they do, they'll think, wow, this is a story that has some legs. It's just a combination of the election, a combination of being isolated. Who knows? But it's just not been a media story.
Jihan, what would you add?
I would agree with everyone. I think if you're out there and you do have access to contact these medias, the New York Times, ABC, CNN, I think you should contact them and ask them why they're not covering this. This is a major, major national story before an election over an issue related to energy, which is, you know, fueling money into the campaign. So I think that if you're out there and you're able to access the media, you should question them. And or I've been seeing suggestions of a boycott. This is a national story. Why it's not being covered and why the international press is here and you have Native media covering it from inside the camp is beyond me. There's access to reach people here. You have ample amount of voices from lawyers, from people from the reservation, from Natives from all over the country, the South Pacific Islands, New Zealand, Native people, tons of everyone. A lot of people are here, and it's an amazing thing to see happening in this day and age.
Mm.
So it is. I am wondering as to why the media is not covering it, but I think people who consume that media need to start questioning the media as to why they're not covering it.
And yesterday in Brooklyn, a number of young Indigenous people took over the offices of Hillary Clinton's Brooklyn headquarters. It was basically in a building, and they were on the bottom floor, and they erected a teepee trying to get a statement to Hillary Clinton. For the very first time, her campaign did release a statement, and she says, "We received a letter from representatives of the tribes. From the beginning, Clinton has been clear. She thinks all voices should be heard. All of the parties involved need to find a path forward. It's important that everyone respects demonstrators' rights to protest peacefully and workers' rights to do their job safely." Mark Trahant, it's the first time that her campaign has commented on this.
Yeah, it's a terrible statement. It was obviously drafted by committee trying to get all the constituent groups in an election excited, and she ended up ticking off everybody. It makes no sense. I was just really disappointed by that. That's, I tweeted Unions 1, Indians 0.
Hmm. Mark, you wrote a piece for Yes Magazine. How far will North Dakota go to get this pipeline? What do you think?
I think they're willing to kill people.
Really?
I mean, that is the unsaid part of that story, that yes, they're willing to arrest people, but more than that, they're willing to use lethal force because this pipeline is that important to them. And the irony is it's just not needed. The oil can get to markets anyway. It's just a way to do it faster and increase profits.
Jihan, what do you think?
No, that's right. It's a miracle that no one was killed yesterday. Mm. I was shocked that there was no one that was killed because the way that they were shooting at people at point-blank range, 5 feet across, I've seen people die in Egypt that way. I reported on deaths of young people dying, being shot at with non-lethal weapons at point-blank range. So it's very shocking that no one was killed or seriously injured based on the force that a lot of people are facing. But I think they'll go above and beyond to make this happen. We're not just the National Guard here. You're talking about divisions of police from all over the country, mainly the neighboring states that are coming here. And I think that, you know, the energy industry, with all the money that they have and the lobbyists in D.C. and the influence they have on both candidates, is also going to be influential in what's happening here as well. And I do think they'll take it as far as that.
And
killing people.
Mark, we have about 30 seconds. What's the larger message that is being sent here?
Well, to me, it's the United States cannot live up to its global obligations unless we stop this pipeline. The math does not work. There is no way we can do it. We've got to reverse course. We've got to turn the dial back towards consumption, and stopping this pipeline is the first step.
Well, there is a Bay Area Solidarity rally today at noon in front of the Department of Justice, 450 Golden State in San Francisco. Find more information online. Mark Trahant is an independent journalist in North Dakota and a member of the Shoshone Bannock tribe. Jihan Hafiz is an award-winning journalist. She was arrested covering Standing Rock on October 22nd, along with more than 140 people. She wrote about that for The Intercept. You can also see her videos. Mark and Jihan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank
you very much for having us.
Thank you. And I'm heading to Standing Rock this afternoon. I hope you can tune in for our show on Tuesday. We'll be live from Bismarck, North Dakota. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with historian Jill Jones about her new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. She says the modern American city is a great place to look at and learn about trees because this fundamentally unnatural environment has a far bigger variety than any crowded forest. Join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
The last time the Chicago Cubs played in a World Series, Bob Newhart was 16 years old. He was at Wrigley waiting for a victory that never came. Bob Newhart went on to become a star of television. The Cubs never made it back to the series until this year. The incomparable Bob Newhart joins us to talk about the Cubs and why he never gave up hope this week on Day 6.
Day 6 from the CBC in Toronto, and your host Brent Banbury this evening at 6. If you've never become a member of KALW, why not make this the day you do? Just click donate at the top of KALW.org and feel great about supporting local public radio that has been on the air for 75 years. And while you're at KALW.org, why not sign up for our e-newsletter? It's free and keeps you informed about all things happening here at 91.7 KALW San Francisco and beyond. Inflection Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.
Yeah. He is the toxic sewer of our karmic consciousness.
I'm Lauren Schiller. Every week on Inflection Point, I talk with women who are changing the status quo. That's Eve Ensler, playwright, activist, and performer. She's determined to put an end to rape culture.
Well, it says that certain men can get away with anything. More often than not, it feels like women are blamed for those sorts of situations rather than the man who's perpetrating it.
And that's Dr. Allison Dahl Crossley of Stanford's Clayman Institute, talking about Roger Ailes. That's just part of our discussion about the state of feminism today. I'm Lauren Schiller. This is Inflection Point. We'll be back right after this.